I always tell people, like, 90% of the ADA is sensitivity. And if you can just sensitize people, then everything kind of falls into place and there's an easier sort of domino thing that will occur.
Hi, Brave Friends. Welcome to our first practical episode of Season 6. This is episode 164, and I could not be more thrilled and honored and in awe of our guest today, Kevin McGuire. Talk about the triumph of the human spirit. Well, Kevin personifies this. He was hit by a drunk driver at the age of 7 and has used a wheelchair ever since. He is the CEO and founder of McGuire Associates, the nation's leading consulting firm specializing in compliance with state and federal disability laws, including, but not limited to, the Americans with Disabilities Act and Fair Housing Act. He's a graduate of Boston University and the Georgetown University Law Center, holds a Bachelor of Arts degree in Political Science and History, and a Juris Doctorate. Kevin is so impressive. His bio is so long and beautiful. I'll share a few more things, but I could go on and on. He has compiled an impressive resume from working with corporations, legislative offices, and state agencies across the United States, and has developed his skills through hands-on experience in government and disability law. He has conducted over 500 conferences, trained over 25,000 facilities, staff people, and lectured widely to conventions, TV audiences, and public sector workshops, and corporate compliance executives. McGuire has also consulted on building projects with construction budgets in excess of $30 billion. And this is kind of a fun tidbit. He has motion, picture, and television experience and served as both a technical advisor and on-screen actor in Oliver Stone's film, Born on the 4th of July. He was also a technical advisor for Gattaca and taught actor Jude Law how to use a wheelchair for his role in that film. McGuire published Patrick, a novel based on a one-week stay he encountered in a New York City hospital in 1978, at the age of 17. Finally, he was the commencement speaker at Boston University's Sargent College in May 2012. Without further ado, I introduce you to the amazing Kevin McGuire. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to Brave Together podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. It's nice to see you again.
It's so nice to see you again. And I am awestruck. And I'm also grateful that you would take the time to be a part of the show today because you have such an impressive resume. You have done so much and continue to do so much great work. So thank you, Kevin.
Well, thanks for letting me be part of it. It's nice to be here.
Well, I'll have to reach out to Elise and also send another thank you to her for connecting us and introducing us. It was really, really eye-opening for me because we don't have a child or I don't have a family member in a wheelchair. And so to go to SoFi for that tour through the eyes of disability and accessibility was very, very eye-opening for me. So I'm grateful that Elise invited me and I got to meet you back then.
Yeah, that was an interesting luncheon. I mean, it really, for a while, it seemed some of the patrons, I think the perception was that they were being ignored, you know, on their concerns with the design. Because it's, you know, a lot of times what will happen, well, firstly, architects just think they know what they're doing, right? And they don't think they need advice or assistance. But then the other issue is that regardless of disability, it could be non-disabled stuff too, but you don't really know like how a building is going to work until it opens. You know, you have an idea and you have a game plan in your mind that you think this is going to, the way people are going to flow left or right or, you know, up or down or whatever. But it's not until you get 70,000 plus people in that space before you realize, uh-oh, you know, this is where they want to park. You know, this is where they want to enter. And you realize that maybe that venue, and I'm not talking about just that football stadium, I'm talking about it in general, when you realize that maybe things have to be altered or changed. So, but that luncheon was a good one in the sense that it wasn't just the patrons, But then we had disability leaders that were there, or leaders in the disability community. So it was a nice kind of cross-section, I think, or I thought.
It was. I learned a lot, and it made me appreciate, you know, what the fans go through to try to attend something that they love and what the roadblocks that they experience. So it was very eye-opening for me and heart-opening for me, for sure.
And in all fairness, not all of my clients, I should say it like that, will do what SoFi did, invite the disabled community in, or people with disabilities, cross-section, blind, deaf, hard of hearing, low vision, physical, cognitive, to hear what are the issues, like what are the things that we need to address. I mean, we've been open now for, I forget the exact year, let's say three, you know, maybe four, but all right, let's see what we need to revisit as we move forward. So, you know, I give them credit for doing that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Kevin, for our audience, maybe share a little bit of your story and your background and how you came to be such a mover and shaker in the accessibility and disability world.
Well, I could lie and say that I come from a log cabin in Kentucky in the hills, you know, something like that. But I was raised in New York, and I was hit by a drunk driver in a nutshell. Like, I was 7 years old. I was playing baseball. I grew up right outside of West Point, the military academy. So I was playing baseball. A guy was intoxicated, drove off the road. And I was left paralyzed from the neck down. And I really was supposed to die. I mean, I was dying. I had my last rites read. I don't remember any of this, but I was just fortunate that I had very strong parents, great doctors, amazing PTs and OTs and nurses, and somehow, and prayer, whatever. But I survived, you know. And then after that, it was my parents. I mean, not only pushing me, like as it relates to PT or OT or whatever, but then pushing, because when I was injured, it was 1968. And when I was finally released from the hospital in 69, March of 69, I mean, that was the dark ages back then. I mean, there was no ADA. There was no Section 504. There was no Rehab Act of 1973. And there wasn't even a concept of mainstreaming. And so I was just fortunate where the district where we lived at the time, I think we had 17 or 18 elementary schools, and they wanted to put me into special ed. And my parents resisted that. And firstly, you know, special ed back then is not like what happens today, number one. And number two, my parents' position was that I had a physical disability and not a cognitive one. And I was so lucky that they found one of the principals in the one of the 18 elementary schools. Her name is Margaret Forey. I will never forget her, because she literally went to the superintendent's office and took my file off of his desk and said, he's coming into my school. And she was one of these old style, she was elderly, but she was one of these old style like principals. She checked their milk cartons to make sure you ate your vegetables and things like that. But she, you know, she treated me no differently than any other person in that school building. And the point is, like, if she had not allowed me into that building, into that school, I mean, I would have graduated from high school in 79, but it would not have been a legitimate degree. It would not have allowed me to go to BU, Boston University, where I did my undergraduate work, or go to law school at Georgetown, where I went to law school. And even then, I mean, God, when I was applying for colleges, thinking back to like, I was looking like in 78, that's when I started looking around. But my choices of schools, colleges, were so limited, because there were very few schools that were accessible back then. And I remember the first visit, campus I visited, the very first one was Fordham University in the Bronx. And their disability services was on the second floor of a building without an elevator. So that kind of like put it in perspective that, yeah, I don't think I'll be attending Fordham. But I was just fortunate, you know, that we found BU. It was a great program. I worked for Senator Kennedy when I was in Boston. Then I worked for a congressman, Hamilton Fish Jr., who was a great moderate Republican at the time. And he was one of these guys when, you know, Democrats and Republicans actually spoke to each other. And he was one of those conduits that to make deals finally happen. I mean, maybe there was a lot of patronage and pork barreling or whatever. But at the time, he was sponsoring legislation. This is like 87. To make polling places accessible for people with disabilities in federal elections. Because again, there was no ADA or anything like that. So I ended up working for him on that legislation. And then I started this firm, and I've been doing this for, God, almost 30 years. So it flies.
Wow. And what is one of the first things that you worked on when you started your firm?
Well, I was lucky in a sense that I had two great fathers. I mean, I was really, really lucky. My natural father passed away shortly after my accident. I mean, he just took the accident pretty hard. And I think it just sort of broke his heart. But my mother remarried, I think, 5 years later. And she married the priest at our parish, actually. It's a great love story.
It's a good story.
That sounds like the Thornbirds or something. But yeah, he left the priesthood and married my mother. But then it to make it more bizarre, he ended up becoming, we stayed in the house that we were living in because there was an elevator put in, it was completely accessible. And he pretty much had his PhD already in psychology through the seminary and going to school while he was a priest. But he ended up setting up his own practice there as a psychologist, private practice. And then he ended up becoming a parishioner in the very parish where he used to be a priest. I mean, he was so beloved. He was a great man. So I was lucky to have had a great naturopather. And then I don't even refer to him as my stepdad. It was more my second father. But he had his own office building. And so I started this practice. And I was lucky to have that office building to work out of. It was, you know, free rent. And I just busted my backside. And initially, I used like family contacts. I was doing a lot of work under Title II of the ADA, which at the time deals, well, it deals with state and local governments. And at the time, they were required, they were in a very specific time mandates to do self-evaluation and transition plans. That's what they're called. And so I got hired by, I don't even know, 40, 50, 60 school districts and municipalities in Connecticut, New York, and Massachusetts to help them with their self-evaluation and transition plans. But my big break, pre-Live Nation, pre-Broadway Across America, who I both work for now, but when Broadway shows would travel from, you know, leaving New York and have a traveling troupe that would travel, go around the country, when they hit Boston, they always played at a place called the Wang Center for the Performing Arts. And they ended up being in a very reactive situation with both the Justice Department and the Commonwealth, it's in Boston, regarding a lot of access issues. And so somehow Joe Spaulding, who's the executive director, heard about me and hired me to help negotiate a settlement with both Justice and the Commonwealth. And then Symphony Hall, the Boston Pops, the BSO, and their summer residents in Tanglewood in the Berkshires, they were in a reactive situation. And again, with the Commonwealth and Justice. And again, I was brought on to help negotiate a settlement. And then where the Bruins and Celtics play, now it's called the TD Garden. They keep changing the naming rights of these buildings. But anyway, they were in a reactive situation too, a very severe one. And it had to do with sight lines, like when you design a sporting venue where, or a music venue where people are expected to stand, you know, whether Bruce Springsteen is coming out on an encore, or at the time, maybe Michael Jordan was going in for a dunk, or again, at the time, Eric Lindros was going in on a fast break, you know, row one would stand up, row three would stand up, row nine would stand up. And then when you got to row 16 on the lower bowl where the wheelchair seats were, all they could see were the lay-by patches of the people in front of them. And so this whole sightline issue, that's really what started my practice and took me national to start working with these architects to get the sight lines correct so that when people stood up in front of a wheelchair location, you could see over the shoulder row one, over the head row two. And again, that job took me everywhere. Paul Allen in Seattle and Portland and Rupert Murdoch and everybody else in LA and Wayne Huizenga in Florida, who owned the Marlins and Panthers and Dolphins. And it just exploded. And then one quick other thing was that then these owners who would be quite wealthy, they would have property interests in other types of spaces. And I would end up working on those. So it wasn't just sports or it's really multifaceted, the properties and stuff that I work on. And I either would get hired in a reactive situation like the ones I described, where Justice or maybe even a private citizen was buying like a private right of action. Again, I was brought in to help mediate it, to make it go away. Or I would get hired proactively, where I was hired by the owner and I was forced under the architect's umbrella or outside counsel to keep things privileged and confidential. And I would ensure, my job was to ensure that the architects, interior designers, and web developers, or whatever, they were doing everything correctly. So it's very interesting, actually, and the two different scenarios of I could be hired, again, reactively or proactively.
And Kevin, how receptive are owners of these teams or owners of these stadiums and arenas and music venues to really making the changes that need to be made so that, you know, members of the disability community can access those venues and attend their favorite sporting events or hear their favorite music artists? How receptive is that world, the top level people who are making the decisions and the changes or have the power to make those changes? Are they receptive? Do you find that people are? Is it 50-50? Is it, you know?
I would say if I had to give a number like that, a percentage, I would say probably 90% positive, 10% people still either being ignorant or insensitive or taking the short route as opposed to the longer correct route. But in all fairness to a lot of the owners, what happened is that initially, like when the ADA was enacted and what was signed in 90 and then took effect in 92, the owners were really leaning on the architects, like just expecting them to comply. It wasn't just like the ADA, it could be a life safety regulation or guideline, right, that they had to adhere to. So the owners were just expecting, you know, they were paying these individuals to do what they thought they would be doing, the right thing. And when it turned out from an ADA perspective, it was an expensive learning curve for a lot of the owners, because it's not that they got caught, but they got put in a corner. They were boxed in only because they relied on the architect or the interior designers to do the right thing or the correct thing. So again, for some of them, like Paul Allen was a great example. He, the co-founder of Microsoft, and he owned the Trailblazers in Portland and the Seahawks in Seattle. And again, he relied on the architects in Portland. It turned out that it backfired. Even though he did make changes, they were extremely expensive. And it wasn't just the physical expense, but like to make things right, that's when I got hired at that point on that job. And we had to take out 500 seats to make these sight lines work. And so, you know, forget the $10 million or whatever it was to do that work. But now you've lost 500 seats multiplied by 200 events a year, multiplied by an average of $150 a ticket, and then all the ancillary things like concessions and stuff that go with it, multiplied over 30 years through the life of the building. It was a lot of money. I mean, a lot of soft loss. Then when he bought the Seahawks and decided to do the football stadium in Seattle, his point was that I'm not going to go through that again. And I'm not going to be put in that type of situation. Because for him, it was like there was a public perception that Paul Allen doesn't like people with disabilities, when that wasn't the case at all. I mean, yeah, granted, he was the owner, but he expected the architects to do the right thing. And that's not what happened.
So do we need to educate the architects, Kevin? Like, how do we proactively not get into that same situation? We need to inform the architects.
Yeah, it's funny. The bigger issue I have, I still think there are architects that still don't get it. And the other thing, like I'm working on a project right now, which I can't describe where it is, but what's going on a lot of times with these owners, I mean, the building is like a washcloth, and they're trying to squeeze as much water out of that washcloth as possible, meaning that they're trying to maximize every inch in that venue, that bowl, whatever, to maximize revenue. And sometimes they'll want to cut corners, you know, and the pushback has to come from the architect. I mean, the architect says have to say no, you know, or, you know, just draw the line. And some architects are still not willing to do that and to tell the owner. Because in a way, the owner's not doing it most times to hurt people with disabilities. They're not looking at it from that angle. They're looking from the other angle, just from a money perspective. Well, if we can get, you know, 20 more seats here, let's do it, whatever. But not understanding that, okay, if we put those 20 more seats in there, it's going to impact our horizontal dispersion or whatever of wheelchair seating. But the other thing that's going on now, though, is more and more of the lawsuits, though, are happening from a sensory perspective. I mean, mainly because people that are deaf or hard of hearing or blind and low vision, there's technology that exists now that allows them to access and experience things like museums that they just, because museums are, they're not just sterile environments anymore, right? Where you go in and just look at something. So much of it is experiential. Like it's either there's something visual happening or something audible happening. And so we have to make decisions about, well, how are we going to make those exhibits as accessible as possible? So more and more of the lawsuits. And then, you know, with the graying of America, that's another issue. I mean, you're having people that are just aging. And as they're aging, they're losing their sight, their hearing, they're losing their cognitive abilities. They're having physical issues. And so that graying of America has an incredible impact on the ADA and how it needs to be addressed. But what I was going to say is that the bigger issue, or I don't want to say fights, but the pushback for me is more with the interior designers, like just to get them to try to incorporate with the furniture, or they call it the FF&E packages, but to, if they're going to design a bar, incorporate it so it's more universally blended in so that you don't even kind of like notice it. It's the, you know what I mean? The access that's being provided, it doesn't jump out. It doesn't look weird or strange. It really looks part of the design. So those are the individuals. It's more interior designers that I'm still butting heads with. I guess that's the best way of saying it. So,
uh-huh. And what is one thing, if you could push a magic button to make a change still in this day and age, what is it that stands out to you? Like, I really wish that this would change or this could be different.
Well, the one thing that's impacting my life, actually, just so if we want to take it more personal, it's with travel. You know, I have over, 6 million frequent flyer miles because I traveled nonstop for so long. But what's happened now, hotels are so notoriously bad about access issues. And I'm being selfish because I'm talking strictly now just from a physical perspective. I'm not talking about deafness or blindness or cognitive. I'm right now talking about physical. Because one of the things that they've done is that, I mean, and you've seen it in any of your travels, but every hotel now has got these high beds. And they've raised these mattresses. And one, if you're older, it's almost like you have to do like a running start to jump to get into the bed. But when you're trying to transfer in and out of it from using a wheelchair, it's really difficult. And it's also scary because you never know, like, if you're going to, I don't know, like, you can be trying to get from your chair into the bed. And then, the wheelchair moves on you a little bit. Or, you know, you're trying to go the other way where you're going from the bed back to the chair. The chair, again, it's not lined up correctly. And then the other are the bathrooms. I mean, they just don't. When I was in Raleigh last week, this hotel, and it was a Hyatt hotel. And it's one of these cookie cutter Hyatt hotels where it's the same look, the same design all over the country, right? You go into the restroom in your room and they have a fold down shower bench. Okay, I get it. One, they have a grab bar though right behind you. So if you transfer onto this shower bench, now you've got this grab bar, which is not supposed to be there. And then the control for the shower head is right next to you. Like if you're sitting on the seat, the shower head is right there, the handheld shower. But the control for the water, it's on the other side of the roll and shower. It's like 5 feet away. So somehow you have to get that water temperature correct while the shower head potentially like starting to flip around like a live wire or whatever. It's so simple to get it right. It is so simple. And how they keep missing it. They've made traveling so, because every time I go somewhere, I'm always asking, can you lower the bed for me? And most places will, and they can do it. It's pretty easy. And actually, it's interesting. The Hyatt Hotel in Jacksonville, I was there recently. I didn't stay there because, again, they wouldn't even talk to me about lowering the bed. So to me, they've made the hotel industry traveling much more difficult for people with physical disabilities and also people that are older. It just makes me sad. I mean, here it is 30 years later after the law has been enacted. We're still dealing with this. I mean, right. That's crazy.
And what about airlines? I mean, I think I heard this from, I don't know if you said it that day or maybe it was Elise was sharing, but you know, where are you supposed to go on an airplane to use a restroom if you're in a wheelchair? Like, that's a crime. I mean, is there hope that there are ever going to be an airline specifically for members of the disability community to be able to travel comfortably, to not have to fast, to not have to fast for a day or two before flying because there's no way to use a facility?
That's exactly what I do. Like, I think I told you, like, I'm leaving for California on Monday. And so going out from Boston, it's about a 6-hour flight. Coming back, you're with the JetWinds, it's about 4.5 hours. But the point is, I have to start dehydrating myself at least like 10 hours before. And I fly out to California, and it's not until we're in the air for maybe 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours, that I know it's safe for me to drink now because I won't have to use the restroom. I just know my body and I know the safe periods. But the other thing about airlines, they're not part of the ADA. You know, they're covered under their own law. It's like I always get the acronym confused, the Aircraft Barrier Free Act, which is so strange because you go to an airport, that's the ADA. You go down the jetway, that's the ADA. But once you step or wheel onto the plane, then you're in dealing with the Aircraft Barrier Act. But I'm lucky in a sense that I have a narrow wheelchair. I have so many miles that I get to fly first class. So I always take the front row bulkhead so I can get the wheelchair there and just transfer, as opposed to having to get transferred into this like straight back aisle chair, which is dehumanizing. And it's just like scary because sometimes the chair will like tip over. And then it's a nightmare for people who are quadriplegics with power chairs, because the wheelchairs could get damaged so easily. I don't know if you saw that thing on the news in Miami like 3 weeks ago where they literally just kind of threw that wheelchair off the plane when they were unloading. Did you see that?
I didn't see the video, but I heard about it and it's just sickening.
But the power chair is even worse. I mean, well, any chair getting damaged is bad. I mean, there's never a good time to have a wheelchair. But when you have a power chair that to try to fix it, that's really, really tough. And like I've had my wheelchair actually taken 3 times. Like it was waiting for me outside. Like I was just waiting. I'm the last one to get off the plane. But someone just thought it was like an airplane or an airport wheelchair. Yeah, this is like a $4,000 sports chair. It's not the one with like the flag, you know, that's attached to it with that's like 40 inches wide or whatever. But I don't know, that's going to be a long one because again, you know, when I was referring to the washcloth with water, all these airlines want to do is maximize the number of seats on that airplane. But yeah, using a bathroom is just totally impossible. And that's sad.
It is. It is. And yeah, my eyes were open to that when I had a guest on the podcast a couple of years ago who is part of the Changing Spaces advocacy in the States. And, you know, the whole adult size changing table need everywhere. You know, it keeps families at home because they don't want to put their kid, teen, adult with a disability. I mean, this could be a parent that you're caring for. It could be a sibling that you're caring for. I mean, we're all one accident away from disability, right, in this world. And they just stay home because they don't want to lay their child, you know, who's not two, on a blanket in a public bathroom because there is no place to change them. Or, you know, they have to change them in the back of their van if they're lucky to have a van, you know. And so it keeps families at home and isolated. And we're already at home and isolated more so than a typical family. So that is a whole world of advocacy that is going on, but feels like a big uphill battle. Lots of changes needed.
It's interesting because you and Elise at that gathering we had in March really highlighted that issue. And it's interesting because I actually was just on the phone with that venue Tuesday, and that actually came up on that topic about adult changing tables or whatever the correct vernacular is. But the point is, like, it really, that was a highlight for me. Like, I learned something, and I always do say that, like, I don't pretend to know everything, but to hear you and Elise speak about it and with the passion and explaining why, two things. One, that venue is addressing it, but two, that's like a highlight for me now. And but that's, in a sad way though, that's something that the Access Board, the Federal Access Board, is going to have to take under consideration and make that part of the guidelines in ADAG. Because unless it's in an ADAG, then it's just like, it's so hit or miss. I mean, because there is no requirement for it. And it's only people that are either sensitive to it or have learned about it. That's when you're going to see it. But that really should be an ADAG. I mean, what is the requirement and where do they go? What's the height of it? You know, you need those. What's the length? What's the depth? What's the height? I mean, you need to know these things.
Right.
But the Access Board really does need to address that issue.
And how do you get that in the ADAG? How do you make that happen?
You go to the Access Board. Well, you can write or contact the Access Board in D.C. and, you know, raise that as an issue. But then I have to be honest with you, although the timing's not that bad, but to get through the Access Board, that takes a while. I mean, you're talking about 2 years of back and forth of logistics. How does it apply in different places? And I'm making it up, like amusement parks or hotels or, you know, sporting venues or whatever. I mean, it's all parks or whatever we're talking about. So they go through all those dynamics. But once they're done, then the Justice Department has to sign off on it. And once it's done like that, then it's properly propagated. And it would, but the timing is good in a sense, like, because the new ADAG, the newest ADAG, it's not going to come out for a few years anyway. So if anybody's going to take it up, this would be the time to take it up because it's you've got 2 years worth of work with the Access Board, probably another year worth of work with the Justice Department, and it probably will be 3 or 4 years before the new ADAG comes out. So
okay.
I can get you a contact if you want one at the Access Board. So
sure, that would be great. I would love to share that with anyone who is interested in pushing, calling, advocating.
Because I honestly don't know if they've given it much thought. I really don't. I didn't hear it so vocalized until you and Elise did at SoFi. And it made perfect sense, right? And then you described Disneyland. When you explained it like that, it's just one of those things that makes perfect sense.
It does. I mean, there are more. I learned this. This wasn't my own research. I learned this from this mom who was on our podcast and who's advocating. There's more doggy relief areas in airports across the country than there are adult changing tables available. And I love my dogs, but I mean, come on. I mean, that's just a shame. That's just a crime that there are more things available with beautiful relief areas and airports with artwork and all of it. It's not just like a little patch. It's this beautiful, expensive space created for animals. Why not for humans?
It's interesting you use that as an example too, because, and I don't want to single them out, but Disneyland, I was involved in something with them, and that was, the issue was somewhat analogous in that there were more relief areas for the animals at Disneyland than there were family restrooms. That's ridiculous. I mean, yeah, and that was part of my work to hopefully change that. I honestly don't know what the answer is today, but about 8 years ago, there were more relief areas for dogs than there were family restrooms. Or now they're called gender-neutral restrooms. So
right. So, Kevin, what's a two-minute pep talk that you would give to anyone who's out there listening who does want to get involved in advocacy, but caregivers are my audience, right? And we're all tired and exhausted, and we're advocating for our families. We're advocating for our children. We have so much on our plate, and yet we're the movers and shakers who are going to make things happen, right? So even though it might feel like a Mount Everest mountain to climb to achieve what we want to achieve, what would you say? Just what would you say?
Well, two things. I think one, I think about something when I was telling you about my two dads, whatever, that I was lucky to have, my natural father who passed, and then my second father, who my mother married, he was a psychologist. And I remember him telling me a long time ago that you needed to be assertive. You don't want to be aggressive, but you want to be assertive. And his point about that, the distinction was that when you're aggressive, you potentially turn people off, right? You could, maybe you come across too combative or whatever, but he said, you've got to be assertive. I mean, and then there's that old phrase too, you're your own best advocate or whatever. And I think like when I'm thinking about you and Elise and the adult changing tables or stations, I think about the disability space is so, it's almost like an infinitum horizontal. And I always say that because it's like, and there's all these verticals in that horizontal plane or whatever. And each vertical is a different issue, and a different issue may be based on a different disability. And it's just endless. And so it's almost like you have to pick and choose your battles, right? Because you'll drive yourself crazy. Like here I am talking about the hotels, you know, the hotel. I mean, it's funny, I can feel myself getting worked up about it because it just drives me crazy. But maybe my point is like, well, maybe that is my personal fight, is going back at the hotels and getting these bathroom things corrected. Because the difference there, though, is that they're there in ADAG. I mean, there's no reason to get it wrong. So although the bed issue, there's no requirement about bed heights and stuff like that. So that needs to be changed. But just like with you describing caregiving, I mean, that's a huge issue. And it's a huge issue for all different types. It's the spectrum of people that caregivers play a role in. It's tremendous. But if that's your fight, make it the single fight. And then you won't, it's almost like you won't spread yourself too thin, and you're drilling deep on one particular issue. That's what I would do. I think that's the more healthy approach. Because again, if you try to spread yourself too thin, you're just going to go crazy. You really are. Like, and maybe that's not the right word to use, but you'll go bonkers. Or maybe that's not the right word to use either.
You'll just exhaust yourself. Yeah, you'll
That's
just completely,
word.
Yeah, you'll just exhaust yourself, and then you'll want to give up. So if you just pick one area, stick with it, you know, not that it's not going to be tiring or exasperating at times, but I think you're better off, like you said, just pick one area. You can't look at the entire world of changes that need to be made. You'll be paralyzed. You'll be absolutely paralyzed.
Because I would do that too. Like, you know, I go into restaurants into hotels, and not just the rooms, but or any type of space. And I'm always scoping out the access, you know, whether it's the parking or the curb ramp and the doors and the assistive listening system, the signage, all these things. And sometimes you have to turn it off. You know what I mean? Or you're not going to enjoy the experience. Like the reason you went out to a restaurant or to a store or to a hotel on a trip or something like that. So that's the other thing I guess I would recommend, is sometimes you just have to turn it off. That's all. So, yeah. But I like your word exhausted better. So I'll remember that.
And then, okay, I want to ask one more question. For the population at large who doesn't necessarily think about disability accessibility because it's just not a part of their world, it's not a part of their family, What's one thing that you would like to say, like, just notice this, or just be aware of this? I mean, in a way that like opens up their heart or opens up their perspective a little bit. I don't mean like shame on you for not noticing. We're not doing that. It's just, have you ever thought about this? Have you ever noticed this? You know, in a way that just enlarges people's hearts and compassion. Is there something that you would say, like, I wish you would notice this?
It's interesting. I'm thinking about, I was in Raleigh, I think I told you last week, right? And I was doing training, and I can mention the Carolina Hurricanes and the PNC Arena. And as you're talking, I realized, wow, I forgot to say something. I just literally, it just dawned on me. Like, it's something that I always mention in my training. And I'm not sure if this is really answering your question, but I always tell people, like, 90% of the ADA is sensitivity. And if you can just sensitize people, then everything kind of falls into place, and there's an easier sort of domino thing that will occur. And so I'm not sure if that answered your question, but I would just ask anybody or everyone out there just to be more sensitive. And if they do become sensitive, or you can sensitize them, then things just start happening and you start seeing more of a change. That's all. So
I love that.
Does that answer your question?
Yes. And that is a great way to end the show today. But oh my gosh, I wanted to keep talking to you, Kevin. So we will again. And like I said before we hit record, I can't wait to cross paths in person again. It will be wonderful.
Well, I'm glad we met in March, and I'm glad we've stayed in touch. And thanks again for having me today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kevin. Take care.
Bye, Jessica. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much for listening today. Do us a favor and leave us a review and a rating so that this podcast can get into the ears and the hearts of more and more moms. Did you know that Brave Together podcast is an extension of our nonprofit organization called We Are Brave Together? We Are Brave Together serves an international community of caregiving moms by offering support groups that are virtual and in person, educational resources, and low-cost weekend retreats. To join us today, go to wearebravetogether.org. Our support and sisterhood await you. Brave Together podcast is for entertainment and education purposes only and is not a substitute and should not be relied on for medical or mental health advice. The use of any content on our podcast, linked in our show notes, or on our website is to be done at your own personal risk. Please seek out a professional to assess your own medical or mental health concerns, because we are all beautifully complex and the content of this podcast is for a broad audience.